Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
You're crazy, you're bonkers, you're silly, you're blah, 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 but all the best people are. And I'm like, fuck you, Tim Burton. You know, so.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Here's a perfect example of what I've been talking about. Since this boy was suckling on his mama's tit, he's been given everything but discipline. And now his idea of courage and manhood is to get together with a bunch of punk friends and ride around irritating folks too good-natured to put a stop to it.
Hey, who do you think you are, huh?
Just dumb kid, huh? Don't kill him.
Hello, everyone. It is episode 185 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, hubberinos.
And also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
We'd also like to welcome chat, who apparently right now, just two people in chat right now. I don't know. Maybe there's more.
There's more.
Maybe there's more people. Yeah, I know there's more. But thank you for coming out here and watching us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Today's big recommend is Secondhand Lions. And let's get on to our small recommend.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Aaron, what do you got?
Yeah, I've been buried in documentaries. I think I mentioned that. And I watched a documentary series, although when you watch it, it really kind of feels just like a 5-hour documentary. And it is called Mr. Scorsese. It is on what is now known as Apple TV. They have done away with the plus. They are now, they have
the
minus
plus system.
They have minus the plus. I think it just dropped this past week. This is as close as I will ever come to designating something as a must watch. Like, this is so good. There is so much information in here that if you are a cinephile at all, and I'm not even like a huge Scorsese guy, I famously don't love Goodfellas as much as most people do, like, you know, those kind of things. And I was enthralled by this. And I actually came away liking a lot of his movies even a little bit more after hearing him talk about them, hearing him go into depth about some of this stuff. There's a few things that make this series really pop. One of them is they got everybody to sit down and talk about these movies. Really, the only significant person missing is Pesci, but he famously doesn't like to do this kind of stuff, and they even mention it in the docuseries. But everybody else is sitting down. You know, Leo talks a lot. Why can't I think of the best actor of all time? Daniel Day-Lewis.
I was about to say De Niro, too.
I could be talking about either one of them, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And they all sit down and chat. And in fact, I think actually Rebecca Miller, who directed this, I think she's married to Daniel Day-Lewis. I think like that probably wasn't a hard get for her to get DDL. But I was blown away by this. Some of the other big thing that makes it pop for me specifically is the amount of depth he goes into his faith and where he was in his faith journey during each of these movies. And he talks about being Catholic and believing and then losing his faith and completely not believing and then refinding it again in a new way. It's just all so fascinating to me. I just highly, highly recommend this series. It's really, really good.
Yeah, and I imagine it goes into depth, too, probably about what he was going through with The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
And how there were a lot of people who were just not understanding what that movie was about. And, you know, I wonder how that – I'm definitely going to watch this at some point when I get the time to, because I think you're right. I think I could watch a whole big documentary about Michael Bay.
Sure.
And – you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, Michael Bay talks about what his philosophy of films are. I don't like many Michael Bay movies. There's probably like two that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I would sit there and gobble that documentary right up, because it's always fascinating to hear somebody who's at, you know, at the top or close to the top talk about what their philosophy of film is and everything. And like, so even if you don't like the person's work, mm-hmm. I think they have a great body of knowledge to hand,
yeah.
you know, hand to us and everything.
This is similar to my philosophy about live music. I'll go see any genre of live music if it's performed well. I don't mm-hmm. listen to bluegrass. I'm not a bluegrass guy, but I will absolutely go to a good bluegrass concert because I mm-hmm. like fine musicianship. So mm-hmm. it's similar in that regard. I had no interest in this until you just said what you said about it, and now I'm going to have to watch this freaking thing. maybe not the Michael Bay one. I don't know about that. But I'm just kidding. I would watch that too.
But just one little thing too. I remember really I really liked Scorsese, but like when the movie Casino came out and there was a making of on HBO, one of those they used to do, I don't know if they still do this, where HBO is like, here's a little 15-minute featurette about some movie that's coming out. And we're just filling time until, you know, it's time to play Beaches or something. And so, like, they did a Casino one. I think it was Casino. I mean, I think they did it on HBO. But, like, they were talking about, like, all the attention to detail he has and you know, like talking about like De Niro in one scene had to wear a certain suit, a certain watch, and the watch had to match with the suit and had to match with the decor and all this other type of stuff. And it's like just stuff like that, like you would never even think about as far as like, this is what I'm going to do to direct this movie. I'm going to make sure that De Niro matches perfectly in this shot, you know, like, you know, stuff like that. So that's where I really started going, it is actually a way higher level than we think of when we're thinking of directors.
Right.
My only qualm with this series is it goes in depth with every single movie in his filmography in a linear fashion. Mm. Like it goes through them by time, except for one.
The only
movie that they don't go into is Hugo. And I really wanted to hear him talk about
That's
Hugo.
Interesting. I like Hugo.
So I do too. And so I'm really curious about that. Why? Like, because I'm not kidding. Everything else is mentioned.
Especially since it's so much of an outlier mm-hmm. compared to the rest of his work.
Yeah.
You would mm-hmm. think that they would want to ask him about that.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, and
that deserves its whole episode on its own. Why we didn't do Hugo?
Right. Yes. Exactly.
We'll cover that in then season two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. What do you got, Jeremy?
Well, after Aaron's must-watch docu-series on one of the mm-hmm. greatest directors of all time, mm-hmm. I feel really good about what I'm bringing to the table this week. A new Mountain Dew flavor.
Holy shit, what is that? Is that some gummy worms?
Okay. Yeah, so it's Mountain Dew Trolley Cherry Lemon Zero Sugar. That's a lot of words.
Oh my God, that sounds delicious.
I love it. I have seen people say it's too sweet. Here's the thing. I mean, if you love trying different Mountain Dew flavors, and there have been hundreds at this point, you're gonna love some and think some of them are too sweet. That's just how it goes. This one mm-hmm. I happen to love, and it does have very strong cherry flavors. And again, very happy that the Coke and Pepsi people have figured out the zero sugar thing to the point that they have, because I really don't miss the sugar, and there's not that mm-hmm. nasty stevia leaf extract aftertaste.
Right.
So I have seen this everywhere. It's in the gas station on the corner. It's in the two supermarkets that I shop at regularly. But it's only in zero sugar. I have a feeling if you made a real sugar version of this soda, no one would drink it because it would be all the sugar in the world in one bottle.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So, yes, definitely watch the five-hour docuseries on the great Martin Scorsese with a Trolley Cherry Lemon Zero Sugar Mountain Dew in your hand.
Right. And you might as well go ahead and get the sour worms while you're at it. You
know, might as well. Yeah. It does really kind of have a sour gummy worm kind of a taste. I like it. And I happen to like those gummy worms. So maybe that's part of the reason. So.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I have not seen these at any store that I go to yet. But if I do, I'm going to try this out because it sounds very good. I also have a documentary. It's not a documentary series, but I have a movie that I watched. It came out last week. It's John Candy, I Like Me.
Man, I'm so not in step with the show this week.
You're in step with yourself, Jeremy, and that's okay. That's what this show is about. Okay.
But hey, I followed your candy flavored drink with candy. John Candy.
That's true.
So, you know, so it all works out in the end. I forgot how much I always have to be reminded. This is how time is, how much I really loved John Candy back in the day. I've discussed this before, like one of my first big movie moments was when our family got HBO and like a lot of movies from 1984 were playing during the time that we got it. And one of them was Splash. Used to watch Splash all the time. This is my introduction into John Candy. And I really, really loved the guy. And I even remember going to see movies like The Great Outdoors and Nothing But Trouble and Uncle Buck, all in theaters and everything. And like in some of these movies, you know, were not good, but he was always good. Who's Harry Crumb? Just like these type of thing. Like he was always good in them. But the documentary starts off with Bill Murray talking about how I wish that there was something bad to say about him. And I hope that the production team here finds somebody who can say something bad about John Candy, because that's something that I would like to. And then they tease that he's got a bad story about John Candy, which he will later tell. And of course, it's Bill Murray, so you take that with a grain of salt. Obviously, it gets a lot. It goes into his life, and then the man his dad died when he was five, and the dad was 35.
Oh my!
And he had to grow up during this without a dad, and like the whole family has like heart problems and everything. Obviously, John Candy back in 1994, that's what took him, was a heart attack. To the point they didn't even talk about this, but to the point that they had to. This was one of the first digital inserts of a character into a movie, because he had died before filming was over, and they found some shot of him like pouring something out or whatever, and they digitally inserted him at the end or something to kind of finish out the movie or whatever. They didn't talk about that in this, but it talks about his life and like how just he's probably a nice guy to the point of that would being a flaw in his character, almost, but too nice, like willing to do anything for anybody, and to the point that it actually affected him health-wise and career-wise. One of the devastating things about John Candy is you know, he was known for being a big dude and a funny big dude, and like anytime that he would try to like lose weight or anything, the industry is basically like, no, you can't do that. You're the big funny guy. So like he always felt like he needed to keep the pounds on so that he could just keep doing his career and everything like that. It goes through his, you know, early days. You know, I think the first thing they mention is Godspell. I'm not sure if he's in Godspell in the Toronto version of it or whatever, but all the people in that Toronto Godspell would end up being in Second City. And then, he was invited along to Second City. He had first started, apparently, like wasn't like great at improv and kind of like hid in the background and everything. And then something just sort of broke through after a while. SCTV follows that. And then of course a big, huge movie career and everything. But if you guys like John Candy, and you know, you've seen a lot of his stuff over the years, you know, you know, how what a presence he was in everything he was. Like, even Home Alone, he's only in it for just a few minutes, and he still somehow makes an impression in that movie. Macaulay Culkin's in there to tell you how old you are, basically. He has some facts talking about how he's 44 now, and he's 1 year older than John Candy was when he died, and he's 7 years older than John Candy was in Uncle Buck. Stuff like that. But this is really, really, really good. And even if, I mean, I think even if you don't know a lot of John Candy's work, you might watch this and go, man, I want to watch everything he's in after this. Hmm. So it's on Prime, this documentary.
This is Colin Hanks directed this, right?
Yeah, Colin Hanks.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
And he's, of course, he's got his dad, Tom Hanks, goes on here and talks a little bit about Splash and
nice.
And when he first was introduced to John Candy and everything, so that's in there too. So
cool.
Yeah, yeah. This was one of the main ones I was pushing for nomination this year for documentaries. I think it's really well done, and it's. It's interesting because so many times documentaries, a lot of the ones that find their way to like awards and the top or whatever, are these dark explorations. And I've mentioned a few even here on the show, like The Perfect Neighbor or, you know, those kind of things. It's nice to also have one that explores the positivity of a human being. And yes, there's tragedy in this story. But it is so full of life and love and positivity in the impact that he had on, it seems like everybody he came into contact with. He was just like one of those dudes. I also really like some of the interview stuff that they show where interviewers are completely insensitive about his weight being a part of his acting and those kind of things. And he's just like, can't people just take me as a human being? You know, like, you know, kind of thing. It's really weird.
You can see how much it affects him on screen. Like, he's sitting there keeping it together, but they're sitting there like, oh, this again, we're talking about my weight again, can we just talk about something else? Mm-hmm. Basically.
Because
there's even a point later on where there's somebody who's like asking him about, is there anybody who tells you that, you know, to lose weight and blah 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 and all that? And he goes you like the way you are or whatever, and he goes, yeah, I don't have any problem with it. And he's like, do you have an issue with it? And he's like, oh, no. And he's like, oh, good, because you asked the question. You know, so.
Yeah, exactly.
So, that's good stuff. Yeah, it's really good. So check it out. It's on Prime. I know you have to bow before the, you know, the Amazon overlords to watch this movie. But
yeah,
it's really good. All right, let's get on to our big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
It's Secondhand Lions, and it's Aaron's turn. So, Aaron, take it away.
Sure. Secondhand Lions is a 2003 heartstring drama that didn't do much at the box office, had limited critical success, and won almost no awards except for the Best Intergenerational Film at the AARP Movies for Grown-Ups Awards. Yes, that is a true thing.
That's prestigious. That's prestigious.
Yes! But it was a movie I loved 20 years ago, and really, what else matters? The movie begins with Robert Duvall recklessly flying a plane underneath a highway overpass and then evading police pursuit by going vertical, which is clearly cheating. Elsewhere, a cartoonist named Walter, who has a striking resemblance to Josh Lucas, receives a phone call with bad news about his two uncles before we are flashed back to a young Walter, played by the discount tween version of Haley Joel Osment. His mom, played by Kira Sedgwick, maybe the only actor with an inverted Kevin Bacon number, is taking him to stay with his two uncles, who have just reappeared in Texas. Sorry.
Oh my God.
Her goal is for him to ingratiate himself to his uncle so that maybe they'll leave their rumored millions to them when they die. They find the uncles fishing with rifles, and it's none other than Robert Duvall and Michael Caine as Garth and Hub. And is Michael Caine really going to try to pull off a Southern American accent for this entire movie? Yes, he is. Walter tries to adjust to the simple life of no television and solicitor hunting. One night while dry brushing his teeth, Walter sees a locked mystery chest with stickers from around the world on it. A bit later, he accidentally leaves himself the key and manages to look inside. There's a picture of a mysterious woman buried in some sand, but it is nothing like the pictures of women that I found in my uncle's hidden chest, so all uncles aren't the same, I guess. But before he can look further, he sees his Uncle Hub heading out to do some lakeside plunger fighting for an audience of canines who seem to be enjoying the show. Sometime later, another group of relatives show up, and the movie makes it very clear that they are the money grubbers looking to grub some money, and we should hate them and their stupid kids. Their presence causes Walter to run off, where he finds out his mom lied to him again about where she was going, so he decides to head towards Montana instead. But his uncles go get him so he can act as relative repellent back at the ranch. Walter's presence along with him, convincing his uncles to spend some money on a skeet launcher, does the trick, and the other set of DNA-connected humans head for the hills. Next up, Garth stops Walter from waking up Hub in another one of his sleepwalking moments and then builds a campfire so he can send us into a flashback within a flashback about the time he and Hub went to Europe during the war, eventually to be known as World War I, met some twins at the Moulin Rouge, got drugged, conscripted into the French Foreign Legion, and ended up sword fighting in the desert for a woman named Jasmine. You know, typical long-lost love backstory stuff. Mm-hmm. Cue the hoe montage. Gardening hose. That was clear, right?
Yep.
Okay, just making sure. It's a beautiful garden, too, but it turns out the salesman only sold them some corn seeds, so now they'll only be eating corn and learning the consequences of not chewing your food fully. Meanwhile, some Missouri boys bring the uncles a roll credits lion that they hope to hunt for sport. But the lion is so old and lazy, they just give it to the boy as a pet, and he promptly and insensitively, I might add, names it Jasmine. They then head down to the market for some Purina lion chow, which is apparently a thing. Hub does all the loading and it puts him in the hospital, which I guess is as good an excuse as any for Garth to continue his Peter Falking and Walter to continue his Fred Savaging as we learn about the Princess Jasmine and Hub's seaside equestrian.
Well, there goes my double feature. I'm just kidding.
And his, they learn about Jasmine and Hub's seaside equestrian meet cute and his swashbuckling rescue of her from a doomed marriage to a sheik. After getting out of the hospital, the trio stop for ribs before some local hooligans drop by to cause trouble, but end up getting their butts whooped because they didn't realize they brought knives to a Hub fight. Then the whole crew ends up back at the farm. The other relatives whose kids let out the titular lion, the uncles, Walter, and even the four hoodlums that Hub beat up at the rib joint are there. They all try to chase the lion but realize it's happy in the cornfield jungle and it's no threat at all and should just be on the loose because of course it should. That's what you do. The relatives leave. Hub gives his manly man speech to the hoodlums and Garth picks up the tale of young Hub and Jasmine. And in this part, Hub spares the sheik's life again, but he gets rich on oil anyway. And despite Walter's curiosity, Garth says if he wants to know about what happened to Jasmine, he'll have to get it from Hub. Next up on the purchase list for my two uncles is a build-it-yourself airplane foreshadowing kit. Wait, is InMedia's res foreshadowing called backshadowing instead? Can I get a ruling on this? Anyways, it doesn't really matter. Let's move on. That night, Walter gets the courage to wake sleepwalking Hub and ask about his love, Jasmine. He says that she and their child died during childbirth. Walter then says he needs to know if the stories are true because his mom always lies and he needs to know what is true. This leads Hub to give him half of the man speech, specifically the part about how sometimes the things that may not be true are the most important to believe in. Like Bigfoot, I'm assuming.
Right.
At least I think that's what he meant. Anyhow, after making Hub promise to stick around so he can give him the rest of the speech when he's older, we get a corn-eating montage and some more rifle fishing. And then it happens. One night, Walter discovers where the money is hidden, and boy howdy, there is a lot of it. And now he wonders if it was stolen, so he asks the dogs what they think. So, of course, shortly after this is when Mom shows back up with a guy named Stan from Vegas claiming to be a cop who knows that the money is stolen. He tells a pretty good story about it, in fact. He proves to be desperate and abusive, but just as he gets the upper hand on Walter, Jasmine the lion comes running from her cornfield to save him and then just dies in the process. Walter's mom takes Stan to the hospital and then comes back later to snag Walter and apparently has suddenly stopped caring where the money is for the moment. After some tearful goodbyes, May promises the uncles that she will ditch Sam, but then on the trip out, she admits she's still going to marry him. That causes Walter to do a Peter Pan right out of that car right here to escape. She stops the car and catches up to him, and he convinces her that if she has to marry Stan, she can at least let him live his best life and walk back to the farm and live with the uncles who actually care about him enough to promise not to do any more dangerous stuff until he's out of college. They keep their promise and wait until he's older to fly an upside-down airplane into the side of their own barn, apparently still wearing their boots or something. Walter returns to the farm after getting the call we saw at the beginning of the movie and finds out that they left all of the money to him. And just when we think we're going to have to fully Walter Mitty ourselves to figure out what was and wasn't true, a helicopter shows up with the grandson of a certain sheik to confirm the uncles were telling the truth and indeed really, truly lived. And that is Secondhand Lions. So curious what you guys thought about this movie.
Is it really true at the end, Aaron? I would also debate that.
We can debate it. We sure can.
That the sudden oil helicopter that shows up with the sheik's son and grandson may not actually be true either, considering that Josh Lucas, who was a thing back in the early 2000s, has immersed himself into comic book writing and drawing, and I guess he does all of it or whatever. So,
or the uncles paid an actor and an actor child, rented a helicopter, had it painted, and said, after we die, fly this helicopter.
I just want to point out that much like last week's helicopter, this helicopter is a jump scare helicopter that shows up out of nowhere, and unlike in real life where you can hear that thing 2 miles away.
Yes, exactly.
In the distance, you should be able to generally hear helicopters. It's kind of amazing. It's kind of like a Rain of Fire where they're like they decide to go to the place with all the dragons and they're like, "We'll sneak in, fly in our helicopter." So I did like this. It was on immediate shaky ground with me though at the beginning, because first off, they ask Haley Joel Osment to emote about every single thing that happens.
Yep.
And everything is heightened. And I don't like heightened stuff. The salesman coming by and like, they got the shotguns. Oh, isn't that funny? The crazy old men got shotguns and they shoot at the salesman who come by and like, hari har, isn't that funny? And Haley Joel Osment is sitting there like they tell him, hey, open your eyes really wide and have your mouth agape at everything that's going on. You're a kid from the city. You don't know anything about this shit. So at the beginning it really wore on me and I was like, I don't know about this. It does pull through, I think. Although I do think it has some very confusing messages, as it goes through, the thing. First off, one of the things that it's sitting there telling you is like the stories that Michael Caine is telling him are beyond fantastic. Do you really even believe it? And then they say, well, it doesn't really matter if these are true or not. You just have to believe them. But then he also had a mom who lied to him constantly. And like, and they were supposed to say that these lies are not okay, I guess, because they hurt him in some way. And these lies over here, they didn't hurt you. So they're, it's okay if you lie about that type of stuff. And of course, I'm not sure if I like the whole idea of them at the end punctuating it by saying all that stuff that sounded really weird and fantastical, and Michael Caine himself said, you don't really believe this stuff, do you? That might have actually truly happened. So I wasn't really a big fan of that. But overall, I you know, it's hard to deny like a really good coming of age story. You have two masterclass actors in Duvall and Michael Caine. I like Haley Joel Osment okay. You know, he obviously was outgrowing his child actor thing, and he's gone on to do some really funny stuff as an adult, but seeing those two guys act off of each other is really fun and really good, and I really like that. And I do like the stories that Michael Caine is telling in all of this. I do like all that, the swashbuckling and the, you know, just like everything seems like he's trying to top each last part of the story that he was telling. And So I really dig that part of it, and I think it adds something to it. But it really does feel like a confusing movie. It's got the okay, and now let's get to the titular Secondhand Lion part of this movie where they're like, it's basically just, I don't know what we're supposed to think from this. It's, I guess, if you're going to die, die doing something that you like and that's, or you love. And that's basically, you know, the lion's whole thing is a foreshadowing of what happens with the plane later and everything. I guess that, but to title the whole movie that, I'm not sure. Maybe I'm missing something about this metaphorical lion that they've thrown into the mix. Maybe there's more that I should be getting from it, but it seems like there's a lot of confusing messages and like a lot of things that this movie wants to do and doesn't quite deliver all the way. And like the other thing about this is that I'm not sure Haley Joel Osment's character has any real motivation in this. There's not anything that we're trying to get for him in this. His mom has sent him there to find the money, but he's not ever in any way trying to find it. He doesn't care about that money at all. So like there's nothing he's learning out of this process, so I just thought that was really weird that there's nothing about his character that he's really learning on the way or how to become a man or anything like that. He really wants to hear that Duvall speech, but that's really about it. So there's not much for him to hang on to. So there's a lot of things to kind of explore about this movie, and I ended up kind of liking it. It's just that there's a lot of stuff I'm like, I'm not sure they were completely focused on this.
So I have a lot of thoughts. I ended up liking it too. My first note was Haley Joel Osment is a really good actor as a child or an adult.
Yeah.
Literally filming this movie as he was going through puberty, as the IMDb says. They shot it in sequence so that because they knew his voice was slowly getting deeper. I'm not sure what's happening, but he's the rough spot for me in this movie for a lot of them. But again, as you said, thankfully we have Duvall and Michael Caine, two of the all-time greats. I think Duvall absolutely stole the role of the movie out from under Michael Caine's feet. I feel bad for Michael Caine because most what he gets to do is tell stories about what Duvall's character used to do as a young guy. Duvall's the one that sleepwalks and, you know, has the fights in the bar. But my biggest issue with this movie, I think, is tone. I think it tries too many different things tonally. There's a moment when they go into the cornfield where everyone goes in single file with a gun, and then two of the money-grubbing relatives' kids are sharing a long rifle as they walk into the thing, and it felt like a Naked Gun moment in a movie that did have some fantastical stuff but didn't go... That why everything with the money grubbing family feels slapstick to me. And then there are parts where it wants to be a take me seriously coming of age drama. And then there are parts where it wants to be fanciful and fun and tell these wild stories. And I'm not sure, to use a phrase I coined that I love, I'm not sure it really cohesives for me by the end as a solid, you know, cohesive project. But I think Duvall is near magical in this movie. He probably always is. I'm fascinated that it was almost Robert Redford and Paul Newman in these roles. And I'm stymied by the fact that it was ultimately Haley Joel Osment who was cast first to try and lure in the older actors to be in this movie. That's how big his star was at that point. But again, if not for Duvall and Caine, I'm not sure this movie would work at all or be anywhere near as fun as it is. But because they're so good and clearly having a fun time, I had a fun time. I do think, from a storytelling perspective, there's like maybe three scenes where Haley Joel Osment goes, "Hey, why don't you tell me some more of that story about Uncle Hub?" And Michael Caine's like, "Really? Here?" And Haley Joel Osment's like, "Well, what else we got to do?" There's like two or three different moments where, in order to get back to that, the movie just has Haley Joel Osment go, "Hey, remember that story you were telling me?" And it doesn't feel supernatural to me when they go into that. I also feel like they go from crusty to liking the kid like that. Like, I needed more, because they give us that, hey, we don't know shit about kids, so if you need anything, you better find it yourself or learn to live without it. And then by, like, the next day, they're, like, telling him stories and, like, being nice to him. And and like you said, Chris, I feel like they do a lot more for Walter than Walter does for them. Walter gets them to spend some money. That's about it. And maybe you could argue he gets Hub to talk a little bit about Jasmine in the end, and maybe that is a healing moment for Hub. I'm not sure. But they do so much more for him than he does for them. Right. And I feel like more of a balance there, perhaps. And again, the firing the shotguns at the traveling salesman feels a little slapsticky because they're firing at them, not like up in the air, like go away. They're kind of like, I think they even hit something that one of them is holding at one point.
Yeah, there's a guy holding up a piece of paper with some samples of something. Yeah.
And I want to talk for at least 30 seconds about the worst hiding place for money of all time.
No kidding. I was going to get to this.
People
was like
across
unreal.
The state believe these guys are millionaires to the point that multiple traveling salesmen drive up every single day, and no one has snuck onto that property at 3 a.m. and looked in the barn. Like, seriously?
Mm-hmm.
That really bugged me, too. I've got some other points I might
if
circle back to.
If it's good enough for Superman, it's good enough for money.
That's true. That's true.
I do want to stop here. You said something about the messaging. That speech, the half the man speech he gives to Haley Joel about sometimes the things that aren't real are the things most important to believe in. That is fucked up philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't like that at all. I don't like that at all. Like, you made a Bigfoot joke, right, when you were talking about it? That's, I feel like, what the movie is saying. Like, it's really important to believe in Bigfoot. It's really important to believe your uncle was a swashbuckler in Africa.
I was thinking of when that speech came up, I was thinking of the speech at the beginning of the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland, where the father is telling young Alice about, like you're crazy, you're bonkers, you're silly, you're blah blah blah, but all the best people are. And I'm like, fuck you, Tim Burton. You know, so
do you want me to defend it a little bit now or later when I talk? Do you have more that you want to get through?
No, you can defend. I think it's
important to clarify what the speech actually says, which is not that when things aren't true, they're the most important to believe. When they may or may not be true, they're the most important to believe. And then he immediately gives two examples that fit the theme of what he means when he says this. The first example that he gives is that people are basically good. That is something that may or may not be true, but is important for him to believe, and really important for him to. I'm just trying to clarify, like, exactly what he means, you know, when he says that. And I want you to remember this, that love, true love, never dies. These are things that you can't prove, but are, in my opinion, in his opinion, important to believe. So it's not that they are certifiably false. It's just that you just can't prove it either way. And sometimes those are the things that are the most powerful to put your faith in, to believe in.
I think true love never dies is provably false.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I guess if you know what happens after death. I guess that's...
I hear what you're saying.
But anyways, that's not a complete defense of the movie, because I think the movie is really messy with that theme. And I think you guys have touched on how messy this movie is all over the place, and I think that's important to remember. And I too kind of cringed against that speech, that I may have been one of the main reasons I loved this movie 20 years ago. So, like, I had that same feeling when he said those things, but then as I dig deeper on it in how I would interpret it and mean it if I said it, I can understand, you know, what he's getting
that's
at.
That's fair. And that's the bad thing about movies, especially movies made by committee and you know, studios and a whole bunch of people have come in and whatever. It's like, we've got to make this message something exactly like we're conveying, you know. It's got to be something that people in general believe in, and you know, we want to reinforce that message about love conquers all,
right,
and, you know, all that type of stuff. So a lot of times I think the truth gets sort of lost in it to make something feel a little bit more, I don't know, like apt for the movie or whatever.
I think there's a real important discussion, like when you talk about optimism and pessimism or cynicism or all these kind of, you know, worldviews. There's a real important discussion to have about where those things meet denial, like where those things meet delusionment, right? There are optimists who are blind optimists, like where it's about denial and delusionment. That's, you know, no, everything's good just because I have to believe everything's good. They're not looking at any kind of reality. But at the same time, I always balk when somebody's like, I'm not an optimist, I'm a realist. Well, you could also say I'm not a pessimist, I'm a realist. Like, you know, there are ways that how we, you know, see things changes our ability to see the truth that's right in front of us. And understanding, like, where that balance is and line is, it's really tricky, but I think really important if you have a worldview to go, okay, you know, I need to deal with the reality of the situation. And optimism and pessimism are kind of choosing where to focus on the reality. But you know, finding that line can be difficult. So yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
I do want to point out two things that I really love that made me smile. The corn eating montage where there's 50 ears of corn on the table is great. And then I love the fact that after he kicks the ass of those four bullies, he takes them home and puts steak on their wounds and tries to teach them a life lesson. Like, most movies wouldn't go that route. Most movies would just have him beat up the bullies to show that maybe those stories he was telling about, maybe that's true. But I love that they brought those guys back. did they ever definitively answer if they robbed the bank to get that money? Or are we just supposed to make up our own mind?
Well, I mean, I think, it depends, like Chris said, on how you take that final helicopter. Because the Sheik, when he lands, says, you know, I had a great grandfather that knew these men and he's obviously very rich. And so I think we're, you know, at least there's an indication there that it's possibly true that they did get that money from the Sheik and not from a bank.
Yeah. Although, and but there's also the other thing there, and you don't know exactly when all this came into play, but don't the bags say New York something on them? Like, it's like, I think that we're supposed to believe those are bank bags, but maybe they are bank bags because they could not have withdrawn this amount of money, by the way. There's no bank that has this kind of money, but I thought the bags that were down in that little base, that little barn cellar thing, said New York something. I don't know, maybe it didn't say bank on it or whatever. I didn't read too closely, but I thought that was to imply that, yeah, they did steal money from a bank. But then again, the Nicky Cat story at the end, that's obviously bullshit. That's like completely that definitely didn't happen.
Yeah, I assumed they got their money from the Sheik in like gold and those kind of things, and then they just over time have, you know, transitioned it into cash.
Maybe they did. Maybe they took it to a New York exchange of some sort and they gave them cash, but that's a lot of cash.
It is.
That's a lot. Yeah. So that's Breaking Bad lying down on the, you know, the brick thing kind of money that they have down there. So
yeah,
I do think that ending is so fantastical that it's one of those like they're asking you, did this happen too? I don't know if that happened. Like the ending is so happy. Like, you know, the kid gets everything and all that. Well, I thought it would have been funny though if they had said the kid gets everything and it ends up being the Sheik's grandson and not.
That's amazing. I didn't even think about that.
That would have been amazing.
This non-defined kid, actually not you. It's this third generation down from the Sheik.
Well, you could let me just say, everybody out there, if you haven't made out your will, when you do, don't use language like the kid gets everything. Yeah. That is not legally binding.
Yeah.
Right.
The kid stays in the picture. I think one of the things I don't like about the muddled messaging about, you know, where the money came from, believing in things that are true or not true, those kind of things, is that they center the movie on what I don't think is the main theme of the movie. If you look at the title and you look at Dying with Your Boots On and you look at there are other conversations that the men have about, there's one beautiful one where Duvall says, or no, maybe it's Kane says of Duvall of a hub. You know, sometimes men have old bodies, but they still have young heart. You know, like they see themselves as their 20-year-old, you know. I identify with that so much as somebody who just turned 50 or whatever. I'm like, I still feel like I'm the 23-year-old version of me. Like, it's the same dude, you know?
I was just having this conversation with my wife the other day. Yeah. Like, I don't, as far as understanding the world, I still feel 22.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And so there's all these beautiful things about this idea of secondhand lions, about how as you age, somehow your worth just diminishes because your number goes up. And the movie touches on it in so many beautiful ways, but then it kind of centers itself on this other muddled message. And that just, I don't know. That's what I was trying to figure out
with this. Like, here we are, we're going to throw a metaphorical lion in here that basically represents Duvall and Michael Caine in this. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be about what worth you have to society after you've hit a certain age, but it really doesn't kind of like right. end up being that movie.
And I think, just to say overall, watching this again 20 years later, it is much messier than I remember it. It is clear that 20 years ago, my mind was much more on the heartwarming elements of it, the beautiful things that they said, those kind of things. Than watching it more of, as I've, you know, been a movie critic for so many years and the things that I've trained my brain to look for, it's not as good as I remember it. But I do think it's like three choices away from being a great movie. Like you mentioned Haley Joel Osment. You cast that as somebody, as a good child actor who's like 6 or 7. And I think the movie is completely different, you know, and works really, really well. Also, I don't think this is a mistake, but they should have just given Michael Caine a reason to have his original accent. It is so distracting to hear him trying to be Southern.
And maybe possible, I think Jeremy slightly touched on this, maybe give him something other than just the guy who tells stories about his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And like, he gets to be in one of the stories, but even in that story, he's like, I helped my brother break out of the prison.
Yeah, he didn't do shit.
And then I killed all these dudes. And then, it turns out, no, my brother actually killed all the dudes. And I just stood there.
I think that is his care. I think their relationship is the doer and the supporter. Like, I think that's what it's intended to be. But, yeah.
I still don't like it. Like, right, I understand. I understand that's what his character is. But it's one of those where it's like, can you give him a raison d'etre as well?
Sure.
You know, like that type of thing. It's like, I get it. He's sort of the middleman to this whole thing, but that's also Michael Caine. He's the top billed actor on this movie. So like, give him something a little bit more than just the guy who tells stories. So
the main decision that I think could have made this really special is to have a different director. That would have, to have somebody who had a little more focus, a little more understanding of how to put this together. Tim McCanleys is how I'm going to pronounce it, wrote The Iron Giant. The man knows how to write a script, right? And I think this was his attempt to be a writer-director, and I just don't think he's great at being a writer-director.
Or because it was his first directing gig, the studio...
Could be.
I think he had done one other movie before this, but you look at his directing career and it's not a lot of movies. And there were wide spaces between each ones that he did. So I don't think that was his bag necessarily, was directing, or at least studios didn't think it was his bag either. And he stopped doing it, but yeah, I agree. Maybe somebody like a Lasse Hallström or somebody like that who does these type of things. Cider House Rules, which Michael Caine's in. He might have been a better person to tackle this.
Yeah, because I think that just cleans up a lot of the stuff we're talking about. Even with, you know, casting and picking a theme and, you know, really crafting the movie to have a consistent tone. Because you're right, Jeremy, the tone is inconsistent. There's just a lot of messiness that I think the right person behind it all could have cleaned up, because I think the script is there. Like, I think there's something
the ingredients are all there. Yeah.
Yep.
Also, before we're done talking about this movie, future gardeners, you do not plant tomatoes, potatoes, corn, and bok choy all at the same time. That will not work out well for you.
That's
okay.
That's fair.
Okay.
But
all right.
Just in case it's all corn, it works out because then it's
yes,
all corn.
That's right.
Because you can make some of that wicked Mountain Dew squiggly gummy worm drink that Jeremy was talking about. That'll be amazing.
Ghost corn syrup.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I've got $1,000 for this. Jeremy, you go ahead.
The one that I had several pop into mind. I've seen some in the chat that popped into my mind. But the one that I settled on, I wanted something that was coming of age that also had fantastical stories that may or may not be completely true. That is the pairing I decided to go with, the reason for the pairing. And it's Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah.
Sure.
He's on that show, and all of the answers happen to be related to these insane events that happened in his childhood and his life that led him to this moment. And I just think they'd make a nice double feature of heartwarmingness. Mm-hmm. There's a word there and I'm missing it, but that's the one I chose. Hopefully that wasn't the top on your list of 1,000.
It is not. In fact, even though I had come up with a bunch and had one ready to go, like, our discussion of this made me come up with one during the show. So nice. I have a totally brand new one, but I'll go over the ones that I thought of, and some have popped up in chat. The Princess Bride is one. The whole old man telling fantastical story to his grandson. Yep. Type of thing. Also, Greedy. We've done Greedy before for Mad World. Greedy sounded like a good one because it's a thing about every time I would come up with a thing that would double feature with this, I was like, that's just one aspect of this movie. Yeah. That's how everything is like just kind of one, you know, it's a one-off thing. So like, yeah, Greedy, because the relatives keep coming over and wanting to get the money and all of that. I thought of Pearl, which is not really anything that's has anything to do with this movie at all, but just the fact that you have this, you know, being out in isolation on a farm and what that might do to you as to your development and everything. Pearl went a different way than Haley Joel. just want you guys to know. I also thought of Bad Times at El Royale because of the burying of the money.
Nice.
And all of that. That was another one that kind of, but Bad Times at El Royale, so different from this movie. I couldn't end up on that one, but with the discussion we had today, I thought of Contact. You're talking about a movie in which Jodie Foster, who is a very fact-based science person who does not believe in God, is looking for her, like, basically looking for her thing, that her stamp in this world, and she's being basically stamped out by dudes who believe in God and tell people what they want to hear, basically, is what it comes down to. And she falls in love with Matthew McConaughey, who's playing a priest in this, and who's always trying to tell her, you know what, there is a God, and I can't prove that there is one, I just know that there is one. And that's what's important to me. And then, of course, he ends up asking her, you know, do you love your dad? And she goes, yeah, of course, very much. And he goes, prove it. So, like, then, of course, the tables are turned when she actually does go into the little device at the end and goes and records all this, basically what ends up being static when she comes back and everything. And she now believes in all this stuff and is trying to tell people what she saw, but doesn't have any proof for it at the end, except for Angela Bassett. Angela Bassett, always the best part of any movie. She's like, it's not important to me that she was gone for like a split second. It's what is important to me is that she recorded 15 minutes of static on that thing. Anyway, Contact ended up being what I thought would be a great double feature for this.
That would lead to some really good philosophical conversations after that pairing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think so. Yeah. All right. Next week's homework. We have not been doing many horror movies this month. I don't think it's by design. We're just kind of doing what we normally do and not, you know, not taking a look at October as we must have lots of horror movies. And the one that I'm going to do for next week is not a horror movie, but it is a very haunting movie, I think. It is called Picnic at Hanging Rock. It is one of Peter Weir's first movies. I can't remember where this hits in his order, but it is about a bunch of girls who go on a picnic, the titular picnic at Hanging Rock, and when that picnic is over, a couple of them are missing, and there's a whole sort of drama around all of that. I haven't seen this movie in a while. It's time to revisit it, especially for a show like this. I think that you guys will love this. Jeremy, I think you told me you have not seen this.
I have not.
I haven't either.
And maybe had, and you haven't either. So good. It'll be an interesting one to go over. I'll be very interested to see what you, how this movie hits you. Peter Weir is probably one of the most underrated directors ever. Possibly. He's got a lot of like great movies under his belt, and we don't seem to talk about him like we do other big directors. He did Dead Poets Society. He did Truman Show. He did Master and Commander. A movie called Fearless with Jeff Bridges he did.
He would have nailed Secondhand Lions.
He would have nailed Secondhand Lions. So did Jasmine, apparently. Anyway, on to that. We're going to do Picnic at Hanging Rock. And that's going to do it for this week. Once again, chat, thank you guys for coming out. We appreciate you so much for coming out and watching us today. Yeah, that's going to do it for this show this week. We'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.
See ya. Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/CinemaSins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's recotopia@CinemaSins.com.
I was thinking about sports this week too, with a couple of like huge fun sports things that happened, and just like how I have a lot of people in my life actually over time that aren't sports fans and kind of actually don't like sports, and I think some of it has to do with that that oftentimes the people who play sports in high school can be bullies, and then so there's this kind of separation from sports that happens. But it's always strange to me when somebody who doesn't like movies or storytelling doesn't like sports, because sports is such this beautiful narrative thing, right? Like just the storylines of the Broncos Giants game this week, you know, just like they don't score a single point until the fourth quarter. They're down by 18 with 5 minutes left and they somehow win. Like that's, you know, that's just like narrative storytelling, and it has this benefit of just being like true and happening in front of you. And like, you know, I don't know. There's just, it's just always interesting to, for me to kind of think of sports as less about, you know, dudes doing sports stuff and more about just like storytelling. Like there's just so much good storytelling that happens.
I've talked about this with people in the past. Why am I a baseball fan? And I think baseball lends itself most to this, these dramatic narratives and everything. But it's like, why are you a baseball fan? Well, I was a kid at the time some of the best World Series ever were played, or had some of the biggest moments. I mean, the first World Series I had any kind of vague recollection of was 1985, the Cardinals Royals, and all the drama that happened in Game Six. That was the first sort of taste into that. 1986, the Bill Buckner game. The whole series goes 7 games. The 1987 series, I don't remember too much about, but it went 7 games. The 1988 series had the Kirk Gibson home run. Just years in a row of like amazing postseason baseball stuff. And that's the reason why I got wrapped up into it. And even though my team that I picked, the Braves, during that time was terrible during the 80s, mm-hmm. I still watched them and loved them, but they weren't nearly the teams that these other teams were. And then I'd watch the postseason. And yeah, these things always are coming up. Like as a Braves fan, 1996 should have had the World Series. Went up 2-0 on the Yankees, lost the third game. In the fourth game, they were up 6-0. And lost that game.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always carried that series as just like one of the most painful things as a fan I've ever had to endure, because it
wild
was that close.
You remember that level of detail. Like, I mean, granted, it's like when the Orioles won the World Series, it was 83. I was only 8, but all I remember is that they won. Like, yeah. I don't remember which games they won or being up 4-0 one game and losing. I don't remember any of those details. I just remember my team won.
I will tell you that 1996 is one of the main reasons why I'm a big non-momentum person. I don't believe in momentum. Although some could argue that you should believe in momentum based on what happened in 1996. But they were down in the NLCS that year. The Braves were down 3-1, and they came back to win that series to go to the World Series, and then won the first 2 games of the World Series, and then lost Game 3, and then had it in Game 4 and just lost it. So like what good did momentum do for that team? Ended up losing the whole thing, even though they had strung up, I think it was 6 in a row in the postseason at one point, and still didn't win it. That's the craziest thing. Or won 5 in a row and still didn't win it. Just imagine that. Your team won 5 in a row in the postseason and still lost. So,
Yeah.
And then that's the thing. That's the thing. You walk a guy, a little dribbler goes through, and then the next pitch the guy throws goes into the stands, and now you're down. That's just like that.
Yeah, yeah. The other big one that happened recently that speaks to another narrative I love in sports is the pursuit of excellence narrative, and that's watching Shohei hit 3 home runs and strike out 10 batters in the same game. It's insane the level of never been done that is. It's just.
Yeah. I've been having trouble comprehending. I'm so glad I was watching that.
Yeah.
Because that is the kind of thing that in 100 years, people will still be talking about that performance in that game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's definitely insane. The problem for us is, you know, we have memories of goldfish and we didn't live in certain eras, but there were eras where pitchers hit all the time.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they were good at hitting some of these pitchers were, because that was expected of them on top of their pitching to be able to hit well. And there were some performances back in some World Series days where pitchers like hit homers and pitched a complete game and stuff like that. But, you know, it's at the same time, you know, we have never seen that really like here in this era. We've never
if it's in the dead ball era, it doesn't count, Chris. That's my that's my proclamation. What did you pick for next week, Chris?
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Oh, all right. I remember it going, oh, I've never heard of that.
This is an early Peter Weir movie.
All right.
When he was actually shooting stuff in Australia and everything. And I first saw it probably 10, 15 years ago, maybe somewhere around there was the first time I watched it.
Why do I know him?
Probably 2 or 3 years ago. But it felt like a good one to revisit. We're in October. We've kind of like not been doing horror movies. This is not a horror movie, but it is a very haunting movie.
Why do I know Peter Weir? Is that Truman Show?
Poet Society and Truman Show.
Yeah, okay, Truman Show.
And Master and Commander. That's another.
Oh, now you've got my attention.
Yeah.
I watched The Last Castle, Chris.
Oh wow!
Yeah. Yeah. That movie is crazy.
yeah. Yes, it is.
The end of that movie goes flat out bonkers. It caught me off guard a little bit because the rest of the movie is kind of like is seriously about something. Like it feels like it's, you know, about leadership and, you know, what it means to lead people and those kind of things. And the end's like, no, we're doing a full scale war in a prison. And it's just, it's wild.
I had a weird experience on that. Cause I was an extra, but I was like, not like there every single day or anything like that. And there was a point where there was a scene where they were like, okay, so at some point all of you are going to go scatter. And I was like, I don't even know what the story of this movie is right at this point. All of you are going to scatter. And then you're going to go find all the tools and stuff like that that you've buried out in the yard. And I was like, what?
I imagine your sin brain just clicking into overdrive, like, wait, prisoners were able to bury weapons in the yard and not be like, how is that even possible?